Is There a Biblical Philosophy of Reason? Was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 11, 2003, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Postmodernism, Reason, and the Church. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching. Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the first few minutes of this talk.
Some help. Where was I going with all this? Oh, but it was a very, for me, it was a very existential dilemma for me. Because on the one hand, my faith was very real and very important and very vital. On the other hand, it seems to me that a human being ought to be rational. And they ought to only believe what their reason tells them is true. And if I hadn't been able to see those two as integrated, I don't think I would be a believer today. I don't think the faith would have won that battle. So, that was an important existential question for me, and yet the Bible itself doesn't go there. You know, we never turn to First Epistemology 7:3 or Second Theory of Knowledge 8:1. You know, you don't have that kind of philosophical essay in the Bible by inspired people giving us the inspired Word of God perspective on what reason is and what truth is and how we define those things and so on. Well, why not? Seems to me there's four options. One, from the standpoint of the biblical view, those questions just aren't interesting. Two, those questions are not important. Three, those questions are not answerable, so we're going to stay away from them. Or four, those questions are not problematic. I don't think it's the first one. I think the biblical authors, the apostles, would find all of those questions just as interesting as I do. I think those are vitally interesting questions to them. And therefore, I think they would think that they are vitally important questions to them. I also think that they think those questions, in a sense, are answerable. They're not skeptics. They're not cynics. They're not the postmodern person who says, oh, well, nobody can know anything for sure anyway, so who cares? I don't think that's the perspective the apostles are taking. I think it's the fourth one. I don't think the apostles think that those questions are problematic. What do I mean by that? They're not problematic because they're not real questions. They're not genuine questions. They're not serious questions. They're not my questions. They're not even, for example, David Hume's questions, right? As you saw in your reading, David Hume as this writer of philosophy raises all these skeptical doubts about causation, his own personal identity, the external world, whether you can know anything. As a writer of philosophical literature, he raises all those questions. But then he goes out and he has a couple of drinks with his friends and a nice game of backgammon, and all is well. When it comes to living his life in society, all of his philosophy gets swept by the wayside. He doesn't believe any of the stuff he wrote in the way that he actually goes about living his life. Even he, the skeptic of all skeptics, can't help himself but live according to the same old principles that every other human being on the face of the planet lives by, and he does so without really any embarrassment. I mean, at one point in his writing he says, nature has so arranged it, you know, has been so kind to us to make us forget all of our doubts in our moment of need. We just don't worry about them. Well, Thomas Reed, in a way, is going to have an answer to that. The reason those doubts don't actually enter into the way you live your life is because they aren't real doubts. No one really doubts their own existence. We can say we do, but we don't really doubt it. Many people have pointed out with respect to Descartes, you know, the person who doubted everything, right? And he finally gets to the point where he's doubting his own existence. And then within, if you've read his meditations, within three pages, he goes from not being sure of anything to having God, the angels, the world, and everything else reconstructed within three pages. Well, did he really doubt any of those things? Most people say, no, not really. This is sort of a game here. This is a pretense. This isn't a serious, vital, real doubt that he's wrestling with. This is all an exercise that he's engaged in. From the standpoint of the Bible, I would argue, because they are not real doubts, we don't really have any question about how you know what you know. All of us know all kinds of things, and we know that we know all kinds of things. And because we know all kinds of things, and know that we know all kinds of things, there's no problem to be solved. We may not be able to articulate what it is that we know. That's a whole other exercise. But in terms of being able to function as knowers in the world who are able to experience life and learn from it and come to know what's true within certain boundaries about life, we are not incapacitated from functioning as knowers. And it's not a question of IQ, it's not a question of education, it's not a function of anything. It's just by virtue of the fact that we're born human beings, we're born people who are able to function as knowers. So, why does the Bible need to come along and explore the ins and outs of what's the nature of knowledge and what's the nature of reason and how does it work? Because it's not solving any problems that are really vital problems to us. So, I think that's the answer to our question. This is not problematic, and the Bible is concerned with the stuff that is problematic. It's addressing issues that we need correction on, that we need insight, where we need wisdom, and would otherwise be lacking it. And it's preoccupied with those sorts of issues. So we don't have philosophy done from a biblical perspective in the biblical canon. Now, I want to shift gears a little bit. This is related, I think, but I'm going to shift gears here a little bit. Let's talk about philosophy for a second. There's two aspects to the practice of philosophy, or if you will, I'm going to argue there's two kinds of philosophy. And it's important to recognize and appreciate the difference and the distinction between them. There, on the one hand, there's descriptive philosophy, and on the other hand, there's prescriptive philosophy. What do I mean by that? When philosophy tells us, when a philosophy comes along and says, a philosophy of investing, for example, and tells us how to do investing, excuse me, or a philosophy of education that is telling us how to do education, then that philosophy is prescriptive. It's actually prescribing a method of education, a method of investing, or whatever we're talking about. And it's suggesting you might be inclined to do it another way, but let me suggest you don't do it the other way, do it this way. I prescribe this method to you. Your life's going to go better, you'll be more successful, whatever, if you do it this way. That's prescriptive philosophy. But there's a whole nother approach to philosophy that we would call descriptive philosophy. In descriptive philosophy, it's not suggesting that our ordinary, mundane way that we go about doing things is wrong and in need of correction. It assumes that we know how to do whatever it is that we're doing, but it wants to think a little bit more deeply about what it is that we are doing and what it is that we all already know how to do. What it is that we all already know, but it wants to explore with greater depth and greater clarity what it is that we all already know or already know how to do. So, for example, thank you. For example, I remember when I was in grade school, junior high, whenever I got introduced to atomic theory for the first time. And the teacher, you're looking at a table there or a desk, and the teacher says, now actually, you've always thought that this desk was solid, but this desk isn't actually solid. It's just made up of these really itsy-bitsy tiny particles with lots of space in between, and they're just so small, and everything is so close together that it seems solid to you, but it's not really solid. Now, there's two ways of looking at that theory. If you look at that as a prescriptive theory, then it's suggesting that you need to alter the way you're looking at the universe. You need to change the way you experience everyday mundane experience. For example, you used to think that you couldn't stick your hand through that table, but aha, it's mostly space. Since it's mostly space, you ought to be able to put your hand through that table. That's not what science has meant by that. They're not saying that you ought to be able to stick your hand through the table. What they're saying is our mundane, ordinary experience is what it is. Solid is solid. We all know what solid is. We don't need to change our minds about what solid is. Solid is always is just exactly what we've always thought solid was. But let's think a little bit more deeply about this thing. And they came up with a theory in a way of describing, a way of articulating the mechanics of a solid body that looks deeper. And with a little bit more clarity and a little bit more precision and a little bit more depth into the nature of a solid object. But it's not for a second saying that's going to change your life at all. You're going to use tables differently from here on out once you learn atomic theory. Not at all. Well, that's simply philosophy being descriptive, not prescriptive. It's important to ask the question, when a philosopher is writing, which type of philosophy are they doing? Are they doing descriptive philosophy or are they doing prescriptive philosophy? Because you can oftentimes be misled as to what they even mean. If you think they're doing descriptive philosophy and they're really doing prescriptive philosophy or the other way around, you can actually misconstrue what it is that they are doing. Let me give an example. If any of you have studied the history of philosophy, you've probably run into Berkeley, Bishop Berkeley. He's referred to by Reed in his readings as the Bishop of Cloyne. And when he refers to the Bishop of Cloyne, he's talking about Bishop Berkeley. Bishop Berkeley was an odd duck. I mean, not only did he teach the philosophy that he taught, but he advocated tar water as the solution to all your ills. If you just drink tar water, you'll be fine. So he was an odd sort of guy, and his philosophy was an odd sort of philosophy. But I really appreciate when I understand what I think he was trying to do, even though I ultimately strongly disagree with him. I think his motives were very right and very ingenious. I think he was an apologist, and he was trying to make a case for the existence of God that he thought would be, you know, kind of a inviolable argument about the existence of God. But he was wrong, and I think Reed is right to point out that he was wrong. What did Berkeley say? What Berkeley said is, we have grown accustomed to thinking that this podium here is made of stuff, substance, matter. I can't remember the word he uses. Does he use matter? I can't remember which word he uses, but that it's made of some material stuff. We have all grown accustomed to thinking that. Then he has these fairly complex arguments that I won't get into, but he makes the case for there's nothing here at this podium except all the attributes of the podium. It's solid, it has this shape, it takes up this space, it's extended, it's this color, and so on. But all we ever know and all we ever experience of the podium are just the various ideas that compose the attributes of this podium. So what he ultimately argues is there really is no such thing as matter or stuff or substance. Everything is simply an idea. There is nothing but ideas. Because, after all, he says, that's all my mind can ever possess or entertain or confront or have are ideas. So when I confront this podium, it's just the idea of the podium that I encounter. It's not stuff or matter. Okay? Well, it's important to ask at that point, what kind of philosophy is Bishop Berkeley proposing? Prescriptive philosophy or descriptive philosophy? Well, I would argue that to understand Berkeley rightly, you have to understand him to be engaging in descriptive philosophy, not prescriptive philosophy. he's not for a second saying that my ordinary experience of the world should be transformed if you believe his philosophy. A podium is still going to be a podium for Berkeley just as much as for anybody else. Whether you believe that ultimately lying behind that is the metaphysics of matter or the metaphysics of an idea, it doesn't change the fact that solid is solid, hard is hard, white is white, smooth is smooth, flat is flat, and that's what this is. So nothing is changed by that. There's a famous refutation of Berkeley's philosophy by Johnson, Samuel Johnson. He went up to the podium in a lecture and said, "As for Bishop Berkeley," and then he kicks the podium. Well, he had misconstrued what Berkeley was saying. I mean, if what Berkeley was saying was prescriptive philosophy, then it ought to change whether it makes any sense to kick a podium or not. I mean, you ought to be able to put your foot right through a podium, right? It's just an idea, according to Johnson. Well, no, Berkeley was never saying that at all. Even to this day, at the university, you'll probably run into professors who will construe Berkeley as if he were writing prescriptive philosophy. And, I mean, it's as if Berkeley is saying, when you leave the room, if you look back really, really quickly, there won't be a table in the room any longer. Because it's just an idea, and once you stop seeing it, it ceases to exist. Well, he had an answer for that. When I'm not looking at it, God is. If it's not an idea in my mind, it's an idea in God's mind, so objects continue to endure. Anyway, that's just to illustrate, whenever we confront any philosophical system or any philosophical idea, we need to be clear, what exactly are they saying? Are they prescribing that my experience be different somehow, or are they simply describing what we all already know and accept? You could make that distinction, if you wanted, instead of prescriptive, descriptive, between reformational philosophy and non-reformational philosophy. A philosophy that's intended to reform the way you look at your life and experience your life, or it's not intended to reform it at all. Now, a philosophical theory can be prescriptive or reformational in one sense, at the same time that it is not reformational in another sense. So let's take an example here. Let's say that we had a philosophical judgment, God made that rainbow. If it were a reformational philosophical judgment about the physics of a rainbow, then what we'd be saying is, you used to think that moisture in the air caused that rainbow, but you would be wrong. God made that rainbow, not water vapor. That would be a reformational philosophical judgment. You were wrong to think it was water vapor and sunlight. It's actually God. Okay, a non-reformational philosophical judgment would be, granted, the rainbow is physically caused by water vapor in the atmosphere, that's true, but more ultimately than that, God is responsible for those physical conditions coming about, as well as the physical laws that cause the rainbow. And that would be a philosophical judgment that is still important, but it's not a reformational statement. It's not a prescriptive statement. It's merely descriptive. It's going deeper. It's asking even more to look at it even more ultimately than we ordinarily do. And that's about the physics of the rainbow. What about if it's a statement about the spiritual significance of the rainbow? Well, that's a different judgment. As a reformational philosophical judgment about the spiritual significance of a rainbow, we'd be saying something like, you may have thought that the phenomenon of the rainbow is simply a random chance occasion of beauty, but that's not right. It's a beautiful gift from the Creator that is fraught with significance in relationship to the nature of God and his purposes for mankind. So you used to think that it was pretty, striking, beautiful, and basically meaningless and random. Don't think about it that way any longer. It's a promise from God. It's fraught with spiritual significance. Well, that's a reformational claim now. You used to think about it this way. Don't think about it that way. Think about it this other way instead, in terms of my judgment about its spiritual significance. I could be making it, however, still saying that God made that rainbow and it intended to be non-reformational. Then I'd be saying, granted, the rainbow is ultimately caused by the Creator God, as is everything, but there's no particular significance to that fact because everything's made by the Creator God, so no big deal. It has no meaning, no significance as an event. It is more or less random and meaningless aspect of divine creation. God's just doing something arbitrary and serendipitous and no big deal. But everything that happens, happens from God, so God made the rainbow. That would be descriptive rather than prescriptive. Descriptive with respect to a theological and spiritual statement rather than physics, but still not prescriptive. Okay, with that in mind then, there are really, that's one distinction. Philosophy is either prescriptive or descriptive. There's another distinction to make in philosophy. Philosophy is either common sense philosophy or speculative philosophy. There's an important distinction there. Common sense philosophy does not deem philosophy as being any better equipped to know what there is to know than the common sense of human beings is. If somebody is engaging in common sense philosophy, they don't think, I am a trained philosopher, I'm going to be able to see things you can't see, know things you can't know, explore things you can't explore, discover things you can't discover on your own just using your common sense. Common sense philosophy doesn't take that perspective. It recognizes a role for philosophy. Philosophy has a task to fulfill, but it is simply to articulate clearly, cogently, and effectively what it is and how it is that everybody's common sense knows what it knows and how it knows it. So we're not trying to improve upon the knowledge of mankind. We're, again, much like descriptive philosophy, just wanting to be clearer and go deeper and be more precise, perhaps, than our common sense usually goes. Speculative philosophy, on the other hand, does deem philosophy as being better equipped than common sense. We can know things that the common sense cannot know. So the task of philosophy is to discover and understand through methods and arguments and devices that are peculiar to philosophy and the philosopher, to use those devices and methods to come to know things that couldn't otherwise be known. Now, okay, of the two, the most dramatic and spectacular moments in the history of philosophy have always been engendered by speculative philosophy, not common sense philosophy. When you look at someone like Plato or Descartes or Hegel, or for that matter Kant or somebody like that, these grand philosophical systems, or these breakthrough philosophical judgments, or this complete revolutionary perspective, change of perspective on things, it's always philosophers doing speculative philosophy who have done these really momentous things in the history of philosophy, not common sense philosophy. So, because of that, your ordinary average layman, when they think of philosophy, they don't think of common sense philosophy, they think of speculative philosophy. They think of Hegel, they think of Plato, they think of Descartes, they think of Kant. That's why, let me back up. Speculative philosophy, I'm going to explore that here in a second. I'm getting ahead of myself. But speculative philosophy tends to say some very bizarre and weird things. Things that the ordinary average, look at Hume. Hopefully you had this reaction to Hume. The people in my group did. And hopefully your reaction to Hume was, this is bizarre. You're saying that I don't even exist? You're saying that cause and effect is not cause and effect? That's not real? It's just a habit of the mind and that's all that it is? Well, you're, as just a non-philosopher exercising your common sense, you go, that ain't right. Cause and effect is real. I do exist. Last time I checked. It's hard to take it seriously. And so if you are not enticed into the game of philosophy, into the philosophical game, the average layman just walks away from philosophy and shakes their head and going, that's weird stuff. I don't have time for that. That's just bizarre, weird stuff. The reason is because you're reacting to speculative philosophy. And granted, by its very nature, speculative philosophy is trying to do better than our common sense. It's trying to suggest that the world is different than our common sense says that we think that it is. And to that extent, it strikes us as weird, bizarre, and outlandish. Now, why does it work? Why does anyone read speculative philosophy? Why do we pay any attention to it? Why has it had the impact and the influence in the world that it has? It's had a lot of influence. Why? I think the way it works is its reliance upon, remember I talked about philosophy, speculative philosophy sees itself as having methods and arguments and devices that are peculiar to the philosopher. Really what that boils down to in reality is philosophers have certain prejudices that they dogmatically impose and that they dogmatically assert into our intellectual activity and into intellectual culture. And these prejudices, they don't make any sense. They're not grounded in common sense. They're not grounded in ordinary human reason. They're just prejudices with no grounding whatsoever. But if you can entice people into accepting those premises, then they begin to take on a sort of a logic of their own. And because they have a logic of their own, reason can then spin out the implications of those prejudices. And what you end up with on the other end is a very, very bizarre view of the world. A very bizarre view of the universe that if you just step back and use your common sense, you go, boy, that's not the way the world looks to me. But it followed logically. I gave you the arguments. I showed you how I got there. I proved to you, the philosopher says, I proved to you that this is the way it really is. Well, yes, he proved it to me, but he proved it to me by getting me to swallow his philosophical prejudices first. And once he got me to swallow his prejudices, then he took me through a line of reasoning where a totally bizarre view of the world followed logically from those premises. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about. At Gutenberg, we explore a little bit. Well, okay, if you've ever read Plato or Aristotle, Your initial, especially you look at the arguments of Socrates. I mean, Socrates is supposed to be this great man, right? I mean, this great philosopher. And don't get me wrong, I love Socrates. I think Socrates is wonderful. But you look at his arguments in the dialogues and you go, what? You proved what? It's just this incredibly bizarre argument. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. He didn't prove anything to anybody's satisfaction. And yet you have all these people going, oh, yes, oh, most certainly, oh, Socrates, oh, of course you're right. Surely you're right. And you're sitting there going, no, wait, stop, slow down. Let's look at this argument a little bit more closely. That doesn't make any sense to me. All of Plato's arguments, all of Socrates' arguments, are built on a whole system of prejudices. And I'm not going to be able to spell out all of them because it's pretty complex. But they have this view of the world that spiritual is up here, material is up here, good is up here, evil is down here, and they go together. They're completely correlated. What's spiritual is good. What's material is evil. So you can build an argument where you say something like, well, that's physical and material, isn't it? Yeah. Well, then therefore it's evil, isn't it? Oh, yes, most certainly, O Socrates. Well, of course. Well, I look at that and I go, well, hold it. Doesn't it sort of depend? But that's because I'm not a part of that culture, that worldview that is accepted, has bought into these prejudices. It doesn't stop there. Up here is spiritual, is good, is unity. Down here is plurality and diversity. Complete inverse of today's prejudices. I mean, do we have philosophical prejudices in our culture? All you have to do is say, diversity is good. And we'll go, oh, yes, oh, Socrates. Oh, most certainly, yes, absolutely. Have we ever thought about it? No, it's not a critical judgment. It's not a decision we've made based on anything except we have bought into and imbibed the cultural prejudices that surround us. That it was exactly the opposite prejudice in ancient Greece. It was unity that was unquestionably good. There's absolutely no question about that. Unity is good. Plurality, diversity is evil. Okay, what am I missing? One. Up here, to be unchanging, to be static and unchanging, as opposed to in flux and moving. What's good is what's static and changing. What's in flux or changing is evil. Look at how that made its way into the Middle Ages and theology in the Middle Ages. In the Middle Ages, the medieval theologians, being influenced by ancient Greek philosophy and its prejudices, the medieval theologians said, God has no feelings. There is no wrath of God. There can be no love of God, at least not in the sense of being a passion. Why can he have no passions? Because passions are motion. Passions are in flux. Passions change. And we all know that's evil. Change and flux is evil. That's on the lower story, not the upper story. God definitely is good and perfect and perfect. So he has to be unchanging. But if God is unchanging, then of course he can't have feelings. He can't have passions. Never mind that the Bible says he does. My philosophy tells me he can't possibly. I should say my philosophical prejudices. If you know Aristotle's concept of the ultimate being or God, Aristotle's concept of the ultimate being or God was that he's often called the unmoved mover. The God of Aristotle has no regard, no concern, no preoccupation with anything other than himself. The unmoved mover is thought thinking about itself thinking. Has no regard for mankind. That would be below his dignity. That would make him imperfect. Well, the medieval theologians were torn. Because on the one hand, how can you read the Bible and not recognize that the Bible teaches us that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son? God had this regard for the world on the one hand. On the other hand, everything in our philosophical system tells us that it's a huge problem for God to love the world. Just like Aristotle showed us and told us. So you see this real collision of worldviews happening among the medieval theologians. They're trying to synthesize the Greek worldview with the Christian biblical data, and it doesn't go together very well. Okay, now, what am I saying in all this? Plato was a speculative philosopher. He disregarded common sense and adopted these certain cultural prejudices. Many of them he probably inherited from his culture. He didn't invent them. He just inherited them from his culture. But based on these intellectual, philosophical prejudices, he took those prejudices to their logical conclusions, and he came up with a view of reality that is very non-commonsensical. That is to say, very speculative. It's a speculation. Maybe the world is like this, not like we've always thought that it was. It's that stream in philosophy, which is a dominant stream, which gives philosophy its bad name. And I would argue rightly so. Because I believe that there is no place for speculative philosophy. Speculative philosophy is wrong, it's false, it's methodologically flawed, precisely because it abandons the true God-given foundation for human reason, namely what I call common sense. When we get to Reid, remember in the opening pages of Reid, he says, if philosophy is not first and foremost, I'm paraphrasing badly, he doesn't say exactly like this, but if philosophy is not first and foremost grounded in common sense, then forget it. And I'm absolutely in agreement with him on that. We do know what we know. And we should never abandon or give up or allow any skeptic to come along and tell us, you don't know what you thought you knew. No, we do know what we know. K. Can we gain greater clarity on some things? Yes. Can we articulate some things more accurately? Yes. Can we be more precise about some things? Yes. The philosopher can help us with that. But we do know what we know, and we should never give up on that. Philosophy needs to start there and then build upon that, not find a way of abandoning, forsaking, or negating and nullifying the common sense that says we all know what we know. Okay, so what is the philosophy of reason that you find in the Bible? I would argue that the philosophy that you do find in the Bible relies upon common sense philosophy, not on speculative philosophy. It even repudiates speculative philosophy. It even downright explicitly criticizes it, I would argue. I think that's what Paul has in mind when he says in Colossians, see to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception. Well, what does he mean by that? He doesn't mean philosophy altogether in every form, in every shape, right across the board, but he does mean there's a certain tendency in philosophy to become speculative philosophy. And who cares about human speculations when you've got God-given common sense on the one hand and divine revelation on the other hand to tell you the truth? We don't need the vain, empty, ridiculous, silly speculations of human beings to teach us. That doesn't make any sense. And that's what I'm saying. So, granted, the Bible doesn't actually engage in common sense philosophy. You know, you don't have a work on an essay on epistemology or on ethics or something like that. It doesn't actually do common sense philosophy, but I would argue that it's grounded on and relies upon common sense philosophy as its basis. Actually, at some points, it might even do it a little bit, but it's not primarily concerned to be doing common sense philosophy. But it does assume it and rely upon it. Okay? We're running out of time here. An objection to two things then, and I'll close with this. I did, for some of you last night, I defined common sense, but let me really be clear here what I mean by common sense, what I think Thomas Reed means by common sense. Common sense does not mean all those things that the people across the world all believe. The superstitions, the prejudices, the silly things we believe, the ignorant things that we believe. Just because 10 billion people in the world believe it doesn't make it true. Thomas Reed doesn't think that. I don't think that. The Bible clearly doesn't think that. The whole mass of mankind can be deceived about certain things and can all be deceived in the same way. That's entirely possible. So this is not truth by majority vote when we talk about common sense. What we mean by common sense is that the human mind, human reason, has basic, fundamental, built-in structures, principles, realities, according to which it operates. Those are given by God, and they're given by God in order to equip me to be a knower, equip me to know what there is to know. And those principles and those mechanisms, those structures, are reliable. They do get me in touch with God and the world and other people out there. I do come to real knowledge, true knowledge of things outside of myself through the mind that God gave me, operating in the way that God intended it to operate. That's what we mean by common sense. That sense, intellectual ability, really, that universally is shared in common by every human being by virtue of the fact that they're a human being. That's what we mean. So, but that being the case, by the end of the week, we need to answer this objection. If all of us are equipped with noetic equipment so that we can know what there is to know, how come there's so much disagreement among us? Don't work too good, right? if we're not coming to believe the same things and know the same things and have the same perspective on the world, then this can't be right. Surely there is no such thing as common sense that allows us to know what there is to know. Surely not, if there's so much diversity of opinion among us. Well, I don't think that refutes it, but it'll take more talking to see why, and we'll get to that later. Okay, I better wrap that up there.
Jack, I was just wondering, you talk about the difference between common sense philosophy and speculative philosophy being that, in the sense that people are coming, all of us come with certain prejudices that inform the way we go about looking at things and that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering, you mentioned that with the speculative philosophy, that those people who are doing that come with these prejudices and then they spin the reason out to end up with their conclusions. What's the difference then with a common sense approach as believers in, does God become our sort of presupposed prejudice and then we spin our reason out on that? Or I guess I'm just wondering, I understand what you're saying about common sense and that sort of thing, but how do we get past not being blamed for beginning with our own sort of predisposed prejudice of believing in the eternal or God or that sort of thing?
Okay.
And it's a big question. It seems like...
Okay, let me... There is a whole school of thought within, especially within Reformed circles. Van Til is probably the most well-known, but it predates him as well. Van Til's really hard for me to understand. I'm not sure I fully grasp what he's saying, but at times it sounds like what he's saying. I don't think this can be what he's saying, but at times it sounds like what he's saying. It is just a presupposition. My belief in God is just something that I presuppose, and then I argue from there, and I reason from there. And at times, he makes it sound like, he almost sounds postmodern at times, namely, that my assumption that God exists is no more or less valid than your assumption that he doesn't exist, and that all that exists is nature and matter and so on. I don't think that's what he means, but he could certainly be read that way. If that's what he's saying, I strongly disagree with that. I would be in the camp of those people who believe that there is evidence for the existence of God, if you will. There are arguments that can be given, and those arguments are sound arguments that ought to appeal to our common sense. Now, do they appeal to a person? Well, that's what we need to talk about. There's a lot more that goes into what we believe than just rationality. And that's where the process gets fouled up, is ultimately when all is said and done, I don't care what reasons you give me, if I don't want to believe something, I ain't going to.
Right.
And I'm going to find all kinds of ways to make it sound as rational as I choose to make it sound that I don't believe it, but I'm not going to believe because I don't want to believe. Okay. Well, that's as much a force in our lives as rationality is. So just because I give an argument to you for the existence of God and you say, I don't find that compelling, doesn't mean it shouldn't be compelling to you. It just means it isn't compelling to you. I mean, it doesn't move you, but it doesn't make it rationally deficient. Ultimately, the one who needs to be the judge of the rational adequacy of an argument is me.
Mm-hmm.
I just need to be my own judge. If it's rationally compelling to me, I don't care about you. Yeah, that's irrelevant because I don't trust you. I don't know where you're coming from. I don't know whether you're being honest. I don't know when you say it's not compelling. I don't even know if you're honest when you believe it's not compelling. It may be very compelling, and you're running like crazy away from it. So ultimately, I just need to judge that for myself. But I think common sense ultimately dictates that God exists.
For example, are you saying if what we see, say, in the Bible makes sense with what we see out in the world, what's going on with people, relationships, is that the common sense that you're talking about, that if what I see, what the Bible is saying, seems to be what's true and what's going on in the world, then that would be, in that sense, sort of the common sense link that I say, okay,
yeah.
this looks...
That'd be part of it. But even more fundamental than that, A classic argument for the existence of God is called the cosmological argument. And the cosmological argument is, why does anything exist at all? God. Sometimes they call it the first cause argument or something like that. I mean, there's different ways of formulating it, different ways of articulating it. Now, is the argument philosophically unassailable? I don't know. Probably not. I mean, I don't know that anyone has actually developed the cosmological argument in such a way and to such a degree and with such precision and with such acumen that it's unassailable philosophically. But we'll talk about this more later in the week. But there's more to rationality than what I articulate. So what I would argue is what I think is commonsensical is that rational intuition, let me call it an intuition, that says, I don't have any accounting for why I or anybody else or anything exists if there wasn't a creator. I think that intuition is fundamentally, intellectually, and rationally sound. And unassailable, inescapable, I would argue. We only escape it by defying reason, by becoming anti-intelligent. In our rebellion against God, we choose to be against reason, if need be, in order to be against God. But I think if just left to ourselves, the natural course of human reason, unperverted by sin, would just look at the world out there and go, yeah, God exists.
I think you kind of answered the question, but in your definition of common sense, I was trying to figure out how it's different from reason itself. I mean, used the word intuition, but I was hearing, you know, structures that are given to us by God that help us, that are reliable, that help us know the world. So can you clarify more at all on, is that reason itself?
I'm using them roughly synonymously. I'm going to make some distinctions later in the week that'll help clarify that. I think there's two very, very different aspects to rationality. Common sense is embedded clearly in one aspect and not in the other. And if you don't mind waiting, I'll talk about that more later.
You talked about the philosophical prejudices of Plato and today, postmodern thinking. But what about for the New Testament writers? I mean, they were inspired by God, but they were certainly surrounded by prejudice. I mean, what should we be thinking about that?
Yeah, good question. Let me give you a long answer. One of the things that in my study of philosophy, one of the things that I've noticed, I saw this in Hume, we see it in Nietzsche, almost every philosopher has some kind of insight that is profoundly true. I mean, they get into something that they see, and they really do see it, and they invite me to see it, and I can really see it too. It's really true. The mistake they make is, you know, it's like the, you know, like the movies where you have this mad scientist who, with this, I can rule the world. That they have this profoundly true insight, and they decide, I can answer every philosophical question with this. And they expand that insight to try to make it cover all of life, all of reality, all of knowledge, all of everything, and then it becomes wrong. Because what was an important, profound insight in this narrow aspect of reality is not true in every aspect of reality across the board. It was only true here. And what made them think that they could interpret all of reality in the light of this truth? Just arrogance, just a flight of the imagination. Why am I saying that? It did come from your question. shoot. Maybe it'll come to me. There was some connection. Where's Hume when you need him? Resemblance, association, what was it? I know what it was. Okay, so what's one of the insights of postmodernism? One of the insights of postmodernism is our prejudices dictate how we think and how we look at the world, how we perceive the world, how we reason about the world. Okay, that's true. Is all thinking by everybody everywhere ruled by prejudice? I don't think so. Is it not possible for a human being to function with intellectual integrity and to actually, against their prejudices, come to learn and know what really is true? I think so. the biblical authors, I think so. And I would argue their writings and their perspective, that's what we mean by inspiration. That's what we mean by the infallibility of the scriptures, is that here we have authors whose insights, whose perspective, whose teaching has not been perverted by philosophical prejudices. And in that sense is pure in a way that other writings are not pure. But by saying that, I'm not saying that it's intrinsically impossible for other writings, uninspired writings, to be pure in some sense. I mean, can't we get some things right sometimes? Can't we know some things sometimes?
So you would say some writers can write without any prejudice or assumptions at all?
In principle.
It would seem like,
at least
if you're in a discussion with someone, a postmodernist, they would say no way. I mean,
right.
How are you going to go there?
Right. They would say no way.
Who besides the biblical authors can you think of?
Well, you can.
Okay.
Yeah. let's be clear what I mean by a prejudice. I don't mean by a prejudice a prior belief. I mean, you can't write without having prior beliefs. But I'm reserving the word prejudice for a prior belief that is not grounded in rationality and common sense. It's just sort of floating out there arbitrarily. I just believe it because I've been taught to believe it, not because I have any good reason in experience and rationality and common sense to believe it. Do the biblical authors have preconceptions, that is, prior beliefs? Absolutely, sure. But what are they rooted in? I think they're rooted in reason, ordinary common sense experience, divine revelation, and so on, all of which are reliable and trustworthy and don't lead them astray into bizarre views of the world, but lead them to the truth, lead them to grasp objective reality.
I guess I was just kind of thinking about if I was inspired by God now, which of course I wouldn't be, but I would have this behind me, this celebrate diversity thing happening that I wouldn't even question, and I would say that the authors would too. I mean, I don't know if that would even go into that specific, their letter writing, you know, but...
Well, but you wouldn't. If you were inspired, you wouldn't. Because to the extent that that became an issue in your writing, you would see the discrepancy between what's true and what's cultural. I think you do see examples of that in the New Testament. For example, look at the way Jesus treated, taught, and responded to women in that culture. That was completely anti-cultural. Completely against his culture. He hadn't absorbed their view of the basic lesser importance of women. He didn't treat them that way at all. He thought that they were co-heirs of grace. Well, and the same with Paul. I mean, you see the same evidence in Paul, I would argue. That the way he interacts with women, the way he worked with women in the ministry, the way he respected them and treated them, was completely against his cultural surroundings.
When I, by virtue of the noetic equipment that you've been describing, come to, this is probably redundant, but true knowledge, when I make a true judgment, is that knowledge of an event or a reality, is that knowledge identical to God's knowledge of that event or reality? So my question kind of goes to what we mean when we say knowledge.
Well, I have to assume not. But I don't mean it's different than God's. I just mean it's not... I mean, God is so different, so other, so completely beyond us and above us that I can't presume to share his experience. I mean, how he interacts with his creation, how he knows his creation, how he interfaces with his creation is surely going to be very different than mine. So I don't experience it and know it in the way that he does. But I don't mean to say by that that his is valid and mine is invalid, his is real and mine's an illusion, or anything of the sort. I'm knowing his world the way, exactly the way he wants me to know his world, which is the way I ought to know his world, which is valid and real. So I don't think it would be important not to diminish the way we know it by admitting that it's not probably identical to the way God knows and experiences it.
So So you mentioned Van Til earlier.
Uh-huh.
Do you think that's how he looks at the incomprehensibility of God in just the way you did, that he, or anybody who makes this fairly sizable distinction between God's mind being other than our mind and his ways other than our ways, that distinction between God's knowledge and my knowledge is what you just described?
Probably. I would hope so. I would hope that's what they mean.
But 1 + 1 = 2 for God in some sense, in the same way it is for me.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if once we abandon that, then really what we're saying is that rationality is completely and totally arbitrary and is simply an arbitrary grid that organizes our world and our experience and doesn't really tell us about reality the way that it is. What I like about Reed is that he's arguing that my rationality is getting me in touch with reality that God created the way it really is. Now, it's getting me in touch with it the way it really is. Am I experiencing it immediately without it being mediated by sense experience? Well, no, of course not. I can't empathize with the rock. You know, I can't jump into a rock skin and know what it's like to be a rock. But the rock can talk to me. The rock can tell me about itself through my sense organs, my sense experience. And God has so designed the world that the rock can really tell me what there is to say about what it's like to be a rock.
And of course, we all know that rock speaks eloquently.
Yeah, very eloquently, very forcefully. With tremendous force and vivacity.
I'm going to come back to something you said in an earlier answer was something about if my rational belief is rational and compelling to me, but it's not compelling to you, that shouldn't bother me because I'm the final arbiter of what's true for me.
The way you put it sounds so bad.
That's why I wanted to put it that way.
Okay, okay.
Because I don't think that's what you meant, but I'm kind of going toward solipsism, sort of a,
okay.
I get to define whatever it is, and just because you have a problem with it doesn't mean it's not true.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, certainly I don't mean that I'm the final arbiter. What the final arbiter is rationality itself, and I may be more or less honest about rationality. And so there's always the possibility that I'm being very, very dishonest. So yes, should it cross my mind that if everybody else disagrees with me, maybe I'm the one that's wrong and not all of them? That should cross my mind. What I was addressing was the phenomenon that many of us have experienced where we're in a conversation with an atheist or some kind of postmodernist or relativist, some crazy perspective. And you know, we make this case that just seems so crystal clear to us. I mean, doesn't God have to exist because this or something like that? And they go, no. There's a famous dialogue between Bertrand Russell and Father Copleston, and you know, basically the argument is about the existence of God. And the argument dead ends because Copleston says, well, doesn't the universe have to have an explanation for why it's there? And Russell says, no. Well, I don't know what else. Copleston, you know, kind of, where do you go from here? But I don't think Bertrand Russell is being honest, frankly. He, if you were sitting in the living room and there's this ghost noise coming from upstairs, and someone says, I think there's ghosts upstairs, and Russell says, no, I don't think so. And if you made the case, well, doesn't there have to be some explanation for why those noises are there? He wouldn't say, no. Our minds don't work that way. Our minds don't allow us to think that. And I think Bertrand Russell's mind is no exception. I think he knows as well as the next person that things need an explanation. They rationally require an explanation. To argue that they don't need an explanation is anti-intelligent. Why is he becoming selectively anti-intelligent in that argument? Because if he follows the reasoning, he's going to have to believe in God, and he doesn't want to believe in God. So you just selectively cut it off at that point and say, no. And what you say is, I don't find that compelling. And what I say is, I don't believe you. I think you find it very compelling. You're just not being honest. I wouldn't say that to his face, but that's what I don't think. But I think that's the truth.
Yeah,
maybe I would. Okay.
Well, I have another question that is related, and that is that, and maybe I'm infected, I don't know, but I don't trust me on a certain level to be able to understand what my prejudices are and to not know what I'm breathing in and to actually be able to clearly decide that something is true. And on a certain level, that's okay with me because I do believe that something's out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that I might get to know it one day when I'm well or mm-hmm. when I'm fixed or whatever. But I don't know. I don't trust that I can go as far as it sounds like you think you can go toward knowing what's true. And I don't know how you would interact with that. I'm just curious.
Well... We should be, to a certain extent, have a healthy distrust. I mean, that's not inappropriate. I just don't think our distrust should ever go to skepticism. I mean, that's what's happened in the modern world. Well, not only the modern world, beginning way back with Hume, and even before that, well, with Hume, where we get to the point where we say, what's the point? There's no use. I shouldn't even think about it. I shouldn't even try to know, because nobody can know. That skepticism, I think, is unwarranted. We were made to know. It's possible to know. Can my knowing be sabotaged by desires, by sin, by culture, and all this kind of stuff? Yeah, it can, and that's why I need to be wary. And that, I would argue, is why the Bible plays a very, very important role in our life as believers, is because it's an objective, infallible check on how are you looking at things here. This is how it appears to you. Let's read and see how it's supposed to appear to you as the Bible lays it out, and that can correct me. And then I also think that all knowledge is a self-correcting process. Yeah, I might be wrong today, but I can discover that I was wrong today tomorrow, and then discover again, and I can grow in my understanding as I learn the mistakes I made. And in identifying a mistake that I made, I understand what kinds of things can make me make a mistake. And I become wiser about the actual process of knowing. And that's where your confidence and ultimately comes from, is as you've watched yourself grow and learn as a knower, you begin to know how the whole process works. And so you can have a reason for being confident about what you are confident, and a reason for being tentative about what you should be tentative about.
I was just going to ask that, how come... in relation to the terms prescriptive and descriptive, I haven't heard those terms from any of my philosophy teachers. If for some reason I was to ask a question, is he a prescriptive or descriptive philosopher?
They'd go, huh?
Professor, they'd go, excuse me? Yeah.
Yeah, they'd go, huh? Yeah, those aren't necessarily in common usage. I had a professor who made that distinction, however, in my program, but that was the only professor who I ever heard use the distinction. And she used the word reformational and non-reformational. That's why I added those. But the concept is not that difficult, and I think they'd all have to acknowledge, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, but it's not a distinction that people are working with all the time and have constantly on the forefront of their thought. But I think it's an important one.
Is that the same with speculation?
I don't know. That's a good question. It is fundamental, and it has led to great misunderstandings. So I don't know. That's a good question.
Well, don't those distinctions, aren't they based upon common sense, which they're not going to buy into begin with?
Yeah, partly. Yeah, that may be part of the reason.
I mean, because the foundation for descriptive is it's based upon a common sense approach.
Because it's actually validating common sense,
right,
to begin with. Yeah, yeah, that's a good point.
I've read a couple of sociology people who, and even another philosopher, who make those distinctions in different terms.
Hmm.
They'll talk about professional philosophy and then everyday philosophy.
Oh, okay.
They'll make the dichotomy and use slightly different terms, but they do... You see that distinction made. I think this one's more helpful.
Can you say something about how faith works into the process of how we know things? Like, if we have a desire to know how things turn out before we act, how does taking an action help us know things rationally?
Can you give me an example?
I guess, like, if we have questions about what's my calling in life or what I'm going to supposed to be doing, or how things might work out that are unclear to us, how does just living life, taking steps and taking action, help things to become clearer in our minds over time? And I guess that's kind of existential.
Mm-hmm. I think if I'm understanding your question, that probably gets not so much into the rationality of our belief as the psychology of our belief. I mean, I will be talking about that a little bit, in that what we believe, what's rational is only one, what reason dictates I should believe is only one aspect of what determines what we actually believe. And so you could explore all kinds of aspects of the psychology of belief. That is, what are the non-rational elements that lead us to believe what we believe that have an effect and have an influence on why we end up believing what we believe? And if I'm understanding your example, that would probably be part of the psychology of belief. And I won't explore that at depth. I'm just going to acknowledge the existence of that and the interplay between that and the rational.
Okay.